All right, so today we're going to dive into something pretty interesting. A case from 1994 out of the Sixth Circuit, United States v. Ledesma and Zajac. And we're looking specifically at the court opinion, but also some analysis of it that kind of breaks down some really important legal concepts when we're talking about criminal liability, particularly in cases where you've got multiple defendants, and kind of unpacking the differences between conspiracy versus aiding and abetting, and how those play out, especially in the context of a pretty big drug trafficking operation.
Yeah, I think this is a good one to kind of unpack these concepts in because it gives a pretty clear example of the court drawing a distinction between those two things.
Right.
And, you know, it can get pretty murky, especially when you have so many different players involved.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, this is going to be particularly relevant for anyone out there who's trying to really get a solid grasp on how criminal liability works when you've got these multi-party cases, particularly in drug offenses.
Exactly. And just the different levels of involvement and what that means in terms of, you know, the charges and how things play out.
So to set the stage a little bit, we've got Josephine Ledesma at the center of this. She's running this pretty extensive cocaine trafficking operation. And we're talking about a huge quantity of drugs here, something like 1,600 kilograms in total. And then we've got Terry Zajac, who's also in the mix, helping out with things like loading the drugs, paying couriers. Now, both of them end up getting convicted of conspiracy, which, you know, at first glance, you might think, okay, well, that makes sense given their involvement. But here's the twist. Zajac's conviction for aiding and abetting gets overturned on appeal.
Interesting.
So that's really the puzzle that we want to kind of break apart for everyone listening. Like, why did that aiding and abetting charge against Zajac fail, even though he was pretty clearly doing things that supported this drug trafficking operation?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely raises the question, like, if he's helping move the drugs and he's paying the people involved in the scheme, like, how does that not count as aiding and abetting? And I think that's where understanding the specifics of how the court defines these terms and the timing of events becomes super important. Because it seems like, you know, obviously his actions did contribute to the overall criminal enterprise, no question there. But there's this legal distinction that really hinges on precisely when those actions occurred in relation to the specific crime that he was accused of helping to commit.
So let's kind of break it down step by step. And start with Ledesma and what she was doing. So she was the one really kind of calling the shots. She was the one recruiting drivers, these guys, the Ferrer brothers, to actually haul the cocaine. She was the one setting up the routes that they were supposed to take. And she even had this system where they had to call in regularly to kind of check in and report their progress.
Wow, so very organized, like a whole system in place.
Yeah, very elaborate. And again, not talking about a small-time operation here. That 1,600 kilogram figure really emphasizes the scale of this whole thing.
Yeah, that's a huge amount. So, I mean, just thinking about that from a legal standpoint, the level of control that Ledesma had, setting up the recruitment, like you said, dictating those routes, requiring the check-ins, that's all really strong indirect evidence pointing to an agreement with others to break those drug laws, which is what you need for conspiracy.
And I mean, when we talk about circumstantial evidence, that's really what we're talking about, right? It's like those facts that when you piece them together, they suggest a certain conclusion. And in this case, it's that there was this agreement in place to engage in this drug trafficking operation.
It's not like they have like a signed contract saying, hey, we're going to do this drug trafficking thing together. But her actions really paint that picture, right? It's like, okay, she's clearly orchestrating this whole thing. There's a pattern of behavior there.
Okay, so now let's shift gears to Zajac.
Okay.
So his involvement includes, like we said, physically loading some of the drugs, about 244 kilograms.
Okay.
And he also makes a payment to one of those couriers, one of the Ferrer brothers. But here's a super important detail about the timing of this. This payment happens after the police had already intercepted one of those vans that was carrying a big chunk of the cocaine, like 351 kilograms. So this is a really important piece of the timeline to keep in mind as we're kind of going through the rest of the case.
Yeah, that timing definitely seems significant. Like, if they'd already intercepted the van, what was the payment for at that point? Like, was it like a prearranged thing or something?
So what happened was the police in Memphis, they stopped the van. They seized those 351 kilos. And then this is a tactic that you see a lot in these kinds of cases, they replaced the real drugs with fake ones.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And then they continue to track the van as part of what's called a controlled delivery.
Got it.
So they're trying to see, okay, where is this van going? Who else is involved in this?
Right, right. Yeah, makes sense.
So Zajac's payment to the courier happens after all of this, after that seizure in Memphis. Okay, so this brings us to the first legal concept we really need to break down, which is conspiracy.
Okay, yeah, let's dive into that.
So what is the actual legal standard for proving a drug conspiracy?
All right, so under 21 U.S.C. Section 846, and this is the specific law that deals with drug offenses, the government has to prove three main things to get a conspiracy conviction. First, they have to show that there was an agreement to violate those federal drug laws.
Okay.
Second, they have to show that the defendant knew about that agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And third, that they voluntarily participated in it in some way. And the important thing to remember here is that everyone involved doesn't need to know every single detail of the plan. Or every single person involved, right? You don't have to have everyone sitting around a table like in the movies. Even a relatively small role can be enough to tie someone into that conspiracy.
Got it. So thinking about Ledesma, the evidence for conspiracy seems pretty clear cut.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you got the testimony about how she was organizing everything, like we said, dictating those routes, setting up the check-in system. It all really strongly suggests an agreement was in place and that she was a central player in it.
Right, exactly. And like we were talking about before, it's a lot of that circumstantial evidence that paints the picture.
Right, exactly. In courts, especially in conspiracy cases, they often look at the whole context, like all the surrounding circumstances, to kind of infer that agreement.
Right.
And Ledesma's actions really create this very clear picture of her being at the center of that coordinated effort to traffic the cocaine.
Right. Okay, so now what about Zajac and that conspiracy charge? We know he loaded some of the drugs, he paid a courier. Does that meet the standard that we just talked about?
Yeah, so in this case, the court found that it did. And they specifically highlighted that even a slight connection to the conspiracy is enough to find someone guilty.
Hmm.
So when you look at what Zajac did, physically handling a significant amount of drugs, making sure that courier got paid, it shows that he knew about the agreement, that it was an illegal agreement, and that he was actively taking steps to help it succeed.
Right.
Even if his overall role wasn't as extensive as Ledesma's.
Yeah, it wasn't like he was the mastermind or anything.
Right, exactly. But he was definitely contributing to that conspiracy's goal of distributing the cocaine.
Okay, so that makes sense. He was directly involved in the actual logistics of moving the drugs and compensating the people moving them.
Exactly. And I think a key takeaway here, especially for anyone studying law, is that even those actions that seem smaller on the surface, they can still be enough to tie you into a bigger conspiracy.
Yeah.
Especially if you know what's going on and you're taking actions that help move it forward.
Right. Okay. So that explains the conspiracy part. But this brings us back to the main question of why his aiding and abetting conviction was overturned.
Right.
So what's the legal standard for aiding and abetting?
Okay. So aiding and abetting falls under a different section of the U.S. Code. It's 18 U.S.C. Section 2.
Okay.
And basically, this law says that you can be held responsible for helping someone else commit a crime, even if you didn't physically do all the elements of the crime yourself.
Okay.
So to prove aiding and abetting, you have to show that the defendant kind of associated themselves with the criminal venture.
Right.
That they participated in it as something they wanted to happen, and that they took some action to make it succeed.
Okay.
But here's the crucial part, and this is where the timing element comes in.
Yeah.
You have to show that the defendant had the intent to help the crime happen during the commission of that specific crime.
Okay, yeah, that phrase, during its commission, that really seems to be the key to why Zajac's aiding and abetting charge didn't hold up.
Exactly, that's the linchpin of the whole thing.
Right.
So the specific crime that Zajac was accused of aiding and abetting was the possession of those 351 kilograms of cocaine with the intent to distribute it.
Right.
Now the court reasoned that that crime of possession, it ended when the police in Memphis seized the cocaine.
Right.
So at that point, the illegal possession was no longer happening.
So even though his payment to the driver, you could argue that it indirectly helped the whole drug trafficking operation continue because it happened after the police had taken the drugs. It doesn't count as aiding and abetting that specific crime of possession because that crime had already ended.
Exactly. The court was really emphasizing that aiding and abetting, it requires you to be helping with the crime while it's still in progress.
Right.
And actions that happen after the crime is over, even if they benefit the bigger picture, like the larger criminal enterprise, they don't fit the legal definition of aiding and abetting for that particular offense.
Okay.
And the court actually said this very explicitly. They said, and I'm quoting here, aiding and abetting after the crime is complete doesn't count, even if it helps the conspiracy overall.
Hmm, that's pretty clear.
Yeah, it's a very bright line rule. So that's why timing is so, so important when we're talking about these aiding and abetting cases.
Right. It really highlights that aiding and abetting is specifically tied to an underlying crime and the time frame in which that crime is actually happening.
Exactly. It's not just about generally helping out a criminal enterprise. It has to be tied to a specific crime.
Right. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the sentencing aspect of this case. So Zajac was sentenced based on a larger quantity of drugs than what he personally handled, right? He was sentenced based on 577 kilograms,
right?
Even though he only physically loaded 244.
Right.
So why was that?
Yeah, so this goes back to that idea of liability within a conspiracy. Under the sentencing guidelines, someone who's involved in a drug conspiracy can be held responsible for the total amount of drugs that were reasonably foreseeable to them as part of that conspiracy.
Okay.
And that were within the scope of that criminal activity that they jointly undertook.
Right.
So in this case, the court found that because Zajac was involved in paying the driver of the van that was carrying that larger amount, the 351 kilos,
right,
that made that full amount, those 577 kilograms, reasonably foreseeable to him as part of the overall conspiracy.
Got it.
So even though he didn't personally touch all of those drugs, his actions connecting into the transportation and the payment related to that larger amount meant he was held responsible for it at sentencing because it was all part of the same scheme that he was involved in.
Right. So it's like because he was part of this conspiracy, he's essentially responsible for the reasonably foreseeable consequences
exactly.
of that conspiracy.
Exactly. It's like you buy into a certain level of risk when you join a conspiracy.
Right, right. Now, he also tried to argue for a minimal participant sentencing reduction, but the court didn't buy it. Why was that?
Yeah, so to get that minimal participant reduction, you basically have to show that your involvement was very, very minor.
Okay.
And that you were kind of on the periphery of the whole thing.
Okay.
But the court found that Zajac's actions, you know, physically loading a significant amount of those drugs, then paying the courier, showed a much more active level of participation.
Right.
It wasn't just like he was passively standing by. He was taking direct actions to move that drug operation forward.
Right. He was playing a more significant role than just a minimal participant.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's highlight some of the key quotes from this case because I think they really drive home some of these points. So Judge Ryan, who wrote the court's opinion, he said, "The connection between the defendant and the conspiracy need only be slight."
Right.
And I think that really emphasizes just how broadly conspiracy law can reach.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That quote really underscores that you don't have to be the mastermind. You don't have to be involved in every single detail of the plan to be found guilty of conspiracy.
Yeah.
Just knowing about it and doing something to help it along, that can be enough.
Right. And then that other quote that we talked about earlier about aiding and abetting, that aiding and abetting after the crime is complete doesn't count, even if it helps the conspiracy overall. That's really the key to understanding why that conviction was overturned.
Yeah, it's super important because it highlights that very specific requirement for aiding and abetting.
Right. And I think it's interesting to kind of contrast that with the idea of Pinkerton liability.
Yes.
Which we often see come up in these conspiracy cases.
Right.
And just to refresh everyone's memory, that's basically the idea that one member of a conspiracy can be held responsible for crimes committed by other members if those crimes were in furtherance of the conspiracy and reasonably foreseeable.
Exactly. Yeah. So you could be held liable for things that you didn't personally do.
Right.
As long as they were part of that shared plan and you could have reasonably anticipated that they might happen.
Right. So it seems like there's a really important distinction there when we compare Pinkerton liability to this aiding and abetting standard that we were talking about.
Absolutely. So Pinkerton liability, it kind of expands that scope of responsibility within a conspiracy.
Right.
Right. As long as those actions are furthering the agreement and they're reasonably foreseeable. But aiding and abetting, it has this much stricter requirement. You have to be directly assisting that specific crime while it's happening.
Right. It's much more about the timing and the specific actions taken in relation to a particular crime.
Exactly. So while Zajac's payment to that courier might have been foreseeable in the context of this larger drug operation, it didn't meet that very strict timing requirement for aiding and abetting that specific crime of possession because that crime had already ended.
Right, because the possession ended with that seizure. Okay, so for everyone listening out there, and I know we have a lot of law students who tune in, what are the kind of core takeaways that we want people to walk away with from Ledesma and Zajac?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing is to really understand the difference between conspiracy and aiding and abetting.
Right.
Conspiracy is about the agreement to commit the crime, while aiding and abetting is about actively helping in the commission of a specific crime as it's happening.
Right. And that timing element is so crucial for aiding and abetting.
Exactly. And the other key takeaway is that circumstantial evidence can be very, very powerful in proving a conspiracy, especially when it shows a pattern of deliberate involvement.
Yeah.
Like we saw with Ledesma. You know, all their actions taken together really painted that picture of a conspiracy, even though there wasn't necessarily a direct smoking gun, like a signed contract or something.
Right.
And then third, when we're looking at sentencing in these drug conspiracy cases, remember that principle of reasonable foreseeability, because it can really impact how much someone is held responsible for, like how many drugs, even if they didn't physically touch all of them.
Right.
And then finally, I think the overarching takeaway here is to always, always pay close attention to the timing of a defendant's actions and how those actions relate to the very specific elements of the crime they're being charged with.
Right.
Because as this case clearly illustrates, timing can be the determining factor in whether someone is found guilty or not guilty.
Yeah, it's a great illustration of how important it is to break down those specific elements of each crime and to really carefully analyze that timeline of events and how the defendant's actions fit into that timeline.
Exactly. I mean, United States v. Ledesma and Zajac, it's a useful case for so many reasons.
Yeah.
But particularly because it reminds us that even if someone is involved in this larger criminal enterprise, whether they're actually liable for specific offenses, like aiding and abetting, really depends on meeting those very precise legal standards.
Right.
Especially when it comes to the timing of their actions.
Right. Okay, so to kind of sum this all up, the Ledesma and Zajac case provides this really clear example of how the timing of actions can make or break a case.
Right.
When it comes to conspiracy versus aiding and abetting, especially in these drug trafficking cases.
It definitely does. And it kind of leaves us with this interesting question to ponder.
Yeah.
How do you think things might have played out differently with Zajac's aiding and abetting charge if he had made that payment to the courier before the cocaine was seized by the police?
Mm-hmm.
What does that tell us about the very specific requirements for aiding and abetting a crime like possession? Just something to think about.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to leave everyone with. Thanks so much.
Thank you.